yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. The show, Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to continue in our series of shows that we've been having in previous 2 weeks on the topic of which way to independent political action. Independent action, political, meaning independent of the two wings of the ruling party, Republicans and Democrats. We're going to assume, as we have in the show, the same, that it's necessary to embark upon independent politics, that neither of the two are really delivering for the rest of the country, in particular for average folks, middle class, working class folks, being left behind. Top 10%, especially 1%, doing very, very well, very quickly, and still doing extremely well. But all the indicators continue to show that the rest of us aren't doing so great. You know, I watched the show yesterday on Bloomberg News. Bloomberg, of course, being the big business network. And there was an economist there who was interviewed from one of the major asset management hedge funds. And it was really revealing. She was interviewed and indicated very clearly that 76% of all the jobs created in the last 4 years, this so-called jobs recovery, 76% are part-time and temp jobs. Well, no wonder there's not enough income and the wages aren't growing. And there's not enough income to sustain consumption. You know, if you look at the U.S. economy the last 3 years, what we got is this stop-go, because business builds up its inventories and the expectation at the second half of the year of consumers getting on board, and then consumers don't get on board because they don't got the money, and then business inventories collapse. And we see at the end of the year and early in the following year, the economy lags again. And we've gone through that 3 times. I've talked about that here on this show, and I've put it on my website as well in articles. But that's the big problem today. In other words, there's no real wage growth, and because there's no real jobs growth. 76% contingent labor, as we call it, part-time temp, low pay, no benefits. All right, so the parties aren't doing anything about that, and a host of all other kinds of problems that I'm not going to get into here. We've talked about them, and we'll continue to talk about them. But we're going to assume that, you know, there is a necessity of some independent political direction in this country, or else we're just going to keep going between this sandwich politics here of the Republican and Democrats. The Republicans make their constituents rich, constituents meaning the wealthy and the corporations and the bankers. They make them rich and wreck the economy in the process. And then the Democrats come in and they can't solve the problem except for the rich. The rest of us get left behind. People get discontented with the Democrats. And the Republicans come and spin their same old strategy. And what we get is a repeat. Old wine in new bottles. Republicans wreck the economy. And by the way, we're about to see that again. As I've warned several months ago, Republicans will take the Senate. And when they do, watch out. Here comes the old George W. Bush policies, and they're under another name, under another cover. More tax cuts for corporations and the rich, more benefits for the rich, and, of course, the rest of us will be even worse off. But because we're all pissed off with the Democrats, they're going to probably get in again. And then watch Mr. Obama. What's he going to do? I predict he's going to do what Bill Clinton did in his last 2 years, and what Jimmy Carter did in his last 2 years, without the Congress, without any toehold in the Congress, having lost both the House and the Senate. I think he will bend to the pressure of the new right-wing policies just to get something adopted to say he did something. And just like Bill Clinton, it's going to be a big corporate rich folks festival in the last 2 years of his administration. Well, all right. Let's leave that all behind for now. We'll talk about it more after the election. Leave it behind. We know we got to do something independent, something different. What is that? Well, 2 weeks ago we started this series and we brought in a couple of old-timers, you might say, who had been engaged in independent political action, advocacy of one shape or another. You might call that the old left approach. And then last week we talked with the presidential candidate Jill Stein of the Green Party to get that perspective on how to engage in independent political action. Well, my special guest tonight is Mark Dudzik. And Mark and I are going to talk about, well, what about a Labor Party approach? Now, we're lucky to have Mark here because Mark was one of the lead organizers, coordinators. I'm not sure what his official title was, which is unimportant, but one of the key guys for sure in the effort that was launched in the 1990s in this country to start a new labor party. This was a serious effort. You know, the unions, at least some of them, were on board with that, unlike today. And they were, you know, it was a serious probe to see whether an independent party, a labor party, could be launched in this country. And we're lucky to have Mark with us today because Mark will talk to us about that topic and tell us what his role was in it. And we hope to talk about the strategy and tactics and organizational structure that was involved in that early, not so long ago, effort to launch a labor party. Now, I need to also say that Mark's current work is as national coordinator of the labor campaign for single payer. In other words, Medicare for all, single payer. That's what we mean. You know, and you look at what's going on now, the insurance companies are really gaming Obamacare and getting all kind of exemptions and planning to raise their premiums 10% or more. We even got initiatives on the ballot here in California to try to stop that 10% by Anthem and all the others, but they're going to get away with it, and that was the big problem. Anyway, Mark is in the middle of that fight here. Mark, you seem to be at the right place at the right time in some of these struggles. But anyway, today we're going to talk about the Labor Party, Mark's experience in the Labor Party. And we want to focus on this whole question of how do you initiate independent political action? What has been the experiences, past and present, in trying to launch independent political action, whether it's in a party form or a non-party form, whatever, but certainly striking out in a new direction, 180 degrees, if necessary, from where things are going with the two wings of the ruling elite party. You know, we don't have a two-party system in this country anymore. We have a one-party system with two wings, you know, and they play this game, wreck the economy and get the rich richer and come in and fool people that you're going to do something about the wreckage and make the rich even richer, and then you go back to the same thing, back and forth. We've been doing that since the 1970s in this country, and unless we do something dramatically different, we're going to be stuck in this Tweedledum and Dee, you know, screw you and screw you again, two wings, and we're going to keep going backwards in terms of standard of living. Okay, I've had my say. Mark?
Yes, Jack. Hi.
Glad to have you here. You know, you were there at the very beginning of the Labor Party effort. You know, give the folks a little history, how it started, and then let's try to translate that experience and to sift out what was the strategy at the beginning and the tactics to support that strategy. Well, how did the organization of this attempt look like, and how did it evolve over the years? We'll talk as we go through the show. But let's start with the beginning. How did it start? Why did it start? And what was the initial strategy and tactics at the beginning?
Sure, Jack. I'll try to give you a quick overview. You know, for those listeners who weren't around in the 1990s, the Labor Party was probably the most significant and serious effort to build independent working class politics since the 1920s. It was a very substantial project at our founding convention in 1996. There were 1,400 delegates that represented over 3 million workers and six national unions were affiliates of the Labor Party and working to build the Labor Party, hundreds of local and regional leaders. So this was a real effort to build out. And I think, you know, what was unique about the 1990s that gave rise to this movement is sort of a coming together of two factors in the 90s. The first was the final recognition that, you know, what academics call the collective bargaining regime, this sort of grand bargain between labor and management that was created during and after the World War II years, that it was a pretty universal recognition that that regime had collapsed. You know, it had really the attacks on labor began under Jimmy Carter, actually, if you want to really look seriously at the history. But they certainly accelerated when Reagan was elected president in 1980, and, you know, his termination of the striking air traffic controllers and the PATCO strike set the tone for a whole climate of union busting and opened up the doors for the rise of what we now call neoliberalism, which is basically a political and economic policy that's premised on, you know, destroying the power of the labor movement. The unions went through a really tough period in the 1980s with constant lockouts and union busting and decertification efforts. Union density was collapsing. And then in the early 1990s, in 1992, after 12 years of Republican rule, we finally elected this guy, Bill Clinton, and he basically followed the same neoliberal playbook that the Bush and Reagan predecessors had followed, in terms of, you know, not aggressively supporting workers' interests, capitulating on national health care reform, attacking the poorest among us in so-called welfare reform. The final knife in the back for a lot of labor people was his aggressive support for the NAFTA free trade agreement, which was the first major sort of globalization treaty that opened the door to, a whole series of other deindustrialization and attacks on the working class, both in the U.S. and
And if I can interject and add to that list before you continue here for the listeners, you certainly pointed to three major retreats that impact working folks under Clinton significantly. But, you have to add to that, folks aren't as much aware that it's under Clinton that the rapid escalation of health care costs begin. And a lot of that has to do with giving the green light, Clinton administration giving the green light to health insurance companies to hospital chains to buy each other up. In other words, the whole antitrust limits were exempted for health insurers and so forth. And health insurers, of course, and bankers, as part of the deregulation that began under Clinton, allowed them to concentrate and tied these companies to Wall Street, and Wall Street, of course, was giving them the money to buy each other out, and Wall Street says, well, you can't get a 5% return on these acquisitions and investments. You have to get a 22-25% return, and then we were off with runaway health care prices. This was under Clinton as well. Also under Clinton, we have the beginning of the destruction of defined benefit pension plans.
Mm-hmm.
He allowed companies to drag money out of their pension funds to pay for the escalating cost of health care. You know, 20% of the rising cost of health care could be dragged out of the pension funds. And then in 97, 98, even more tax cuts for business, which became the template for George Bush later. And then at the end, even proposing privatizing Social Security. So, you know, it was devastating under Clinton. But I just had to add that. I'm sorry. Please continue.
I mean, we could go on
for
hours on the crimes of that era and, you know, and as they continue today. But really, you know, it kind of reached a crisis moment in the mid-90s after the passage of NAFTA. And, you know, a significant section of the labor movement was exasperated with the lack of fight in the national labor leadership and exasperated with their unwillingness to take on the Democratic Party when they adopted anti-worker policies. And, you know, that played out both in a growing opportunity to talk about independent labor politics, and it also played out in a sort of a palace coup that took place in the AFL-CIO, where a number of large national unions challenged the leadership of the AFL-CIO, which was then led by a guy named Lane Kirkland. I don't even want to get into his history, but you know, who had clearly not really challenged, you know, the neoliberal orthodoxy and the Clinton regime. You know, we elected a guy named John Sweeney who, you know, ran on a program of revitalizing the labor movement, organizing 1 million workers a year. So there was this really a moment of excitement in the mid-90s. And, you know, connected to that, I think, was a somewhat of a rise and a reinvigoration of sort of some of the older left-wing currents within the labor movement. Some leadership came to office. Some new generation of leaders emerged, people who had been radicalized during the civil rights and the anti-war movements in the 60s and were now, you know, local and regional union leaders and were willing to think about new ideas and new alternatives. And then, you know, the end of the Cold War kind of took away the vicious power of red baiting that had kind of kept the left in line in the labor movement for several decades prior to that. So, you know, all of these things kind of came together to create an opportunity to talk about new initiatives and independent politics. And the idea really started in my union. I come out of a union called the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers, which is now part of the steel workers. And, you know, we were, you know, victims of the full bore of globalization and anti-union policies throughout the 80s and the 90s. And in the late 80s, 1989, a guy by the name of Tony Mizaki got elected to national office in our union as part of a new coalition that came together to run our union. Now, Tony had been a longtime labor visionary, had been very leader in the OCAW, lost a bid for the presidency in the early 80s, and then kind of wandering in the wilderness for a few years, but then kind of reemerged as a leader in this new coalition. And Tony had always been an advocate of thinking about independent labor politics. You know, what we decided to do, through a series of internal discussions in our union, you know, we got a lot of pushback, particularly from union staffers and folks who had been sort of accustomed to working with the Democrats, that this was too radical, the members wouldn't support us. And Tony was convinced that, you know, this idea would really resonate with the rank and file. So we developed a political action questionnaire, and we asked our members a series of questions about their view of politics. The two crucial questions that people answered was one, you know, whether they agreed that both political parties are dominated by the corporations, and secondly, whether they thought that it was time for labor and working people to have their own party. And we found that wherever we gave that questionnaire, from Maine to Texas, a majority of our members said that both political parties cared too much about the corporations and too little about workers, and that they felt that unions ought to begin to be the process of building a party of our own. And then we began to roll that out to other unions, asking them to survey their own members using this this methodology. And everywhere we went, from nurses to municipal workers to printers, whatever kind of demographic category, we found that there was a majority support for this idea that it was time for working people to have their own party. So that was really what created the beginning of legitimacy for the idea, within the broader labor movement. And the basic strategy of the Labor Party as it was being launched was to pull together and move a significant section of the institutional labor movement into a commitment to break with their lockstep relationships with the Democratic Party and to begin to put resources into building a party of our own. And that was really the sort of the broad stroke of what, we felt needed to be done as a first step.
So the initial strategic effort was to get certain unions aligned?
Class interests. We had to have a significant section of the institutional labor movement in the room at all times with us, both to build legitimacy, to build the, have access to the networks of working class activists and organizers around the country, and to have the sort of institutional resources that only organized labor could provide to such an initiative. So, we were geared at reaching the kind of change agents within the labor movement who could pull those folks together.
So what was, how would you describe the initial strategic effort as attempting to get local unions or national unions to adopt a resolution to form a labor party or to explore the direction of a labor party? How would you describe that?
We adopted a multi-tiered strategy. We had Tony Mazzocchi's colleague, Bob Wages, was the president of OCAW. He was on the AFL-CIO Executive Council and, had been part of the group that had supported Sweeney's effort to win the AFL presidency and stuff. So, at that level of the labor movement, we urged the leaders, the national leaders of the movement, to create space and to, create opportunities and stuff to allow this this movement to gain voice and to get access to its members. And then, from below, we felt that, really the people who were going to build this party would be that sort of network of local and regional union leaders and activists and stuff, the people that you count on whenever you're in a tough fight, the people who come forward and, really do all of the kind of organizing and the work on the ground. And so, the vision was to begin to pull them together and to have them do two things. One, move the issue up within their union and, try to pull more and more support within their union. And then secondly, to move it out and begin to create some relationships and structures with other unions in their communities and with other, working class organizations in their communities. And the first tool was the political survey. People did that all over the country, but also sponsoring a number of forums and participating in some huge labor struggles that were going on. There was the multi-year fight with a number of companies in Decatur, Illinois. And I don't really have time to get into all of the details of that, but those fights really kind of mesmerized the the fighting side of the labor movement and brought a lot of people together. And, you know, our folks were very active in those fights. A number of the leaders of those fights took a public stance in support of the need for a labor party. And so, you know, those kind of things kind of built momentum and moved us forward.
So it sounds like the strategy was to get the as many national leaders of unions on board to allow this labor party movement to one survey their respective local union members to see what the attitude was. Correct me if I'm wrong here, and then to pursue these kind of surveys, just more of a tactic, I guess, to sort of take a sense of the attitudes here on part of rank and file. And you said it always was, when you were able to do it, overwhelming in support of forming a party. So that was the main tool in the main strategy, which was supplemented by forums of various kinds with and participation in struggles. Can you elaborate on how, beyond just the survey tactic, these forums, what were they, like coming to union meetings and talking about a labor party, or going to picket lines? What was that?
You know, one would be like the, you know, we would, you know, get one or two or three prominent unions or labor organizations in a city or a county to sponsor a public event, and then work to invite, you know, other key labor leaders and activists together, and then sit and listen to either a debate or a panel discussion, or you know, some kind of opportunity for people to put these issues out and talk and chew them around and move back and forth about, you know, do we need to do this? How do we begin to do this? You know, who do we have to have in the room to do this? And, you know, creating that kind of momentum. And then the other thing would be to kind of, you know, within unions to find ways to educate and mobilize people. So, you know, for example, we developed a training program called Corporate Power and the American Dream, which used the small group activity method to, you know, bring people through a number of training modules about how corporate power has grown and how it exercises its power, and, you know, some ideas, begin to think about some ideas of, you know, what politics would look like if they were conducted on behalf of the majority.
So this training module would be within different unions?
Although sometimes, you know, we would hold them for folks in a geographic area. They were, you know, within unions. You know, most unions have sort of an internal, you know, education program. A lot of them are pretty undeveloped, unexciting projects, you know, and this was an opportunity to really engage people. You know, by using a small group method, people got to really, you know, participate directly in the discussions and really bought into the solutions as they emerged.
Okay. What unions would you say tended to support this kind of activity and this strategy the most? Were certain parts of the labor movement that appear more committed to it? Obviously, the oil, chemical, and atomic workers must have been, because Mazzocchi and yourself come out of that. But what other unions were most conducive or most you know, interested in supporting these efforts?
You know, at the time in the mid-90s, I would say that the unions that tended to gravitate towards this tended to be unions of blue-collar industrial workers. You know, steel workers, auto workers, machinists, teamsters, transportation workers. These were the folks that were really sort of at the cutting edge of the sort of corporate assault on the working class in the 1980s and the 1990s. You know, it was their, you know, their sort of standards that they had set over the previous 40 years that were under attack and then affecting the entire working class. And they also tended to have much more of a lively internal culture where members, and a lot of them came out of the old CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which prided itself on sort of internal union participation and democracy. But they tended to be, much more connected directly with the lives of their members. And so there was a space there, in their union halls and their union functions and stuff to engage with people around this issue. So that was sort of where a lot of it came from in terms of national unions that began to come together. I mean, at first there were some of the older sort of left unions that had always been calling for this who kind of stepped up, unions like the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, which had been, since the 1940s had been calling for the launching of the Labor Party, and the United Electrical Workers Union, and some similar unions like that stepped up. But then also unions that, had kind of undergone some of the same experiences as my union, really stepped up to join the fight. The United Mine Workers Union was an early supporter. The Railroad Brotherhood, the Maintenance of Way Workers, joined in shortly after they had a national rail contract imposed on them by the Clinton administration, and they became major supporters of the Labor Party effort. Some very large sections of the government employees, AFGE, American Federation of Government Employees, joined in. If you recall, Vice President Gore, under the Clinton administration, launched a program that was euphemistically called Reinventing Government, which was really what it was is subcontracting stable union government jobs out to the private sector was its actual implementation. And so, those folks really were at the brunt of that, and they came forward. So some of these national unions came to this because of the pressures, within their own organizations to really do something under the horrendous attacks that they were placed under.
Your list conspicuously leaves out early support at a national level by unions of public employees who yet weren't under direct attack as they are today. Were there any public employees, teachers, and SAU, AFSCME, and some of the others who came into this effort, or were they pretty much still outside of it?
On the national level, they didn't come along because I think they thought, as you just pointed out, they kind of thought that they were going to weather this whole assault, and that their relationships with the politicians were going to protect them from the kind of attacks that were other workers were facing. But there were very large sections of those unions that did come forward. A number of teachers' unions, particularly higher education workers, who always had a less stable kind of relationship and were less directly connected to local political machines, were involved. Some very large healthcare union sections of SEIU were active in the Labor Party organizing efforts, and a number of other groups in New Jersey, where I was based at the time, the leaders of the state workers unions, which were mostly represented by the communication workers, were very active supporters of the Labor Party. And I think that's more out of the sort of activist background that they came from than because of the fact that they were public employees. So, it was a mixed bag, but, the real dynamism in the 90s, came, I think, from the sort of blue-collar industrial transportation world.
Did it ever, the effort ever get beyond the educational? In other words, the strategy initially is clearly, let's see where our members are. That's a typical union leadership response, and you know, ridiculously so. You don't want to get too far ahead or out of whack with your own members. But it seems that these surveys show that there was strong interest, particularly in certain segments, to doing this. So, you know, they opened up to the movement, their membership base, and you were able, apparently, to mobilize some local membership beyond this. Did it ever get to the point beyond education of running candidates?
Well, I mean, in 1993, we launched an organization called Labor Party Advocates, which was an organization to do exactly what its name said, to advocate for a Labor Party. We had an initial meeting. We had 82 unions represented in the room in Chicago, Illinois. And, you know, it was the beginning to create a more structured and strategic approach to building a party. And then, you know, as the activities of that organization grew, there was a growing pressure to actually come together and launch a formal national Labor Party organization. And, you know, it's actually some ways the excitement got, you know, was moving faster than, you know, the capacity of the organization to sustain it. You know, it's just a real push from below to move forward. And we held a founding convention in 1996 in Cleveland, Ohio, 1,400 delegates present. And at that convention, we came together around a program for economic and social justice, a multi-point party program about what a Labor Party stood for that I think, you know, stands well as sort of a statement of you know, what a working-class political program should be in the U.S. It called for things like a, you know, national living wage and the right to a job and a national health care program, free education from pre-kindergarten through graduate school, decent housing, these type of issues. And, you know, it connected it to, you know, very real, politically realizable goals. These weren't sort of utopian schemes, you know. These were all things that could be easily accomplished in a society where workers' interests were nurtured. So we came together on that program and then began to wrestle with what it would take to run political candidates, and this was really sort of a very, you know, the most contentious part of where we needed to go as a party. You know, there were folks who felt that we needed to immediately run political candidates regardless of our ability to either seriously support their campaigns or to seriously control their policies in the unlikely event that they would even win. And then there were others who, you know, probably never wanted to run candidates. They just wanted to scare the Democrats a little bit and, you know, make them take them more seriously. So that was sort of a broad range of people. I think the general consensus on running candidates was that this was part of a party-building project, that we would run candidates that were able to run on the basis of substantial labor support within their district, that had, you know, the kind of party organizations that were capable of supporting the candidacies down to the precinct level. I mean, it doesn't make sense to run someone from office if your organization doesn't even have enough people to be poll watchers in every precinct that they're running in, or doesn't have enough resources to even, you know, print campaign materials and do basic operations. So we began to set some real conditions in terms of what we needed to do to have candidates who could run with the assurance that they had substantial, not necessarily universal, but substantial support from.
How would they communicate that? Say there was a district and some unions, you know, that wanted to run a candidate.
And that was, you know, we ran a couple of minor candidates, you know, during this whole building process. And, you know, we also began to develop national issue-based campaigns around some of the core organizing issues that we were organizing around in terms of workers' rights and what we call Just Health Care, which is a campaign for single-payer health care and free higher education and the right to a job. We began to develop those campaigns out as a way to develop a presence around the country. And in some cases, we participated in Massachusetts, Maine, and Florida in organizing non-binding referenda in favor of single-payer health care, which all passed by substantial majorities.
You mentioned you did run candidates in certain places. I presume that those who wanted to run a candidate and get the endorsement of the Labor Party initiative here would have to show the leadership of the movement that you had sufficient resources. Was that
the
typical
practice?
They had
to develop a proposal, a campaign plan, you know, that included, you know, who was going to support them, what resources they had, what their organization was on the ground, you know, whether they, you know, the an understanding of who the candidate was and that this person wasn't, you know, going to, you know, sell us out before they even got sworn into office, as is so often the case in politics in this society. So we needed some structures to, you know, keep them in a disciplined relationship with the Labor Party. So, you know, they were reasonable but fairly substantial standards. You know, we didn't, the leadership of the Labor Party didn't feel that you necessarily would build the party just by sort of slapshot running anybody who wanted to run for any office they wanted to run for. We felt that that was ultimately demoralizing and could kind of provide a lack of focus and, you know, discredit us among the forces in the institutional labor movement that we needed to have at the table as we move forward.
How many candidates were actually run? Well, maybe you don't have the exact number, but
there were only a few.
What years are we talking about?
They were minor candidates. We ran a candidate for the utility, I think it's called the Utility Commission in San Francisco, Utility Board. You know, we ran a couple of school board races. That was pretty much about it until, you know, much later when we launched the South Carolina Labor Party, where they ran a... They're currently running a candidate now for Congress, actually. But that was about it in terms of candidates. There were very few.
So there was no real putting up challenges directly at the national level, House of Representatives, or even Senate, state level, statewide offices.
No,
avoided, I guess, sounds like.
We never reached the capacity where we could build those kind of credible challenges.
Mm-hmm. Was the fact you didn't have something to do with union leadership wanting to avoid those confrontations at the time?
Well, you know, you'd have to ask the leaders themselves what they felt about it, but, you know, I would just say that, you know, we didn't have the kind of organization in any, like, congressional district during that period that, you know, was strong enough to pull together a credible candidacy that could pull, you know, substantial support from the labor movement in that district. We didn't have it. And, you know, quite honestly, we didn't, you know, I think the thinking was that we needed to do more work to build support within the institutional labor movement before we started running off haphazardly running candidates. And we had a toehold in the institutional labor movement, but we needed to win more people over. We needed to build out that project that was really probably the main organizing focus of the National Labor Party after the founding convention, was to pull in more real participation from the institutional labor movement, kind of become a a real force within that world.
Was there any effort to join forces and mobilize with community organizations? Sounds to me like it was strictly in a very much an internal strategic focus here to get more and more labor on board, and it wasn't really reaching out to the community and say, let's really run after a particular candidate here and there, and establish jointly with legitimate community organizations a local mobilization for something different than the two parties. Is that a fair appraisal?
There were some community organizations that came forward in the Labor Party project. There was a group called Kensington Welfare Rights Union, which organized welfare recipients in Philadelphia, and they developed out through a national network of poor people's organizations. They were very active in the Labor Party and were represented on our national council. There was a number of environmental justice organizations that were also participants in discussions. But I would have to say that, our main emphasis was that, to have a party of labor, you have to have the really existing labor movement in the room. And, our main emphasis was on moving that movement into the room. Now, in addition to that, there were other sort of independent political initiatives that were circulating around during that period of time. There was an organization called the New Party, which felt that you could build power for the working people by doing something called fusion, which is endorsing major candidates on a separate party line and voting for them on a separate party line, using that leverage to try to influence them. And they were very active at that point in time and ended up launching in New York State something called the Working Families Party, which still exists to this day. There was a very strong effort among the Greens to adopt a program that included economic justice issues. Ralph Nader's candidacy in 2000 was probably the peak of that, and they basically adopted our economic program. Tony Mizaki spoke at their convention that nominated Ralph for president in 2000. We never endorsed the Nader candidacy. We didn't. It was our policy not to endorse candidates except those who would run on the Labor Party line, because we felt that was a real party building issue. But some of our leaders, some of the unions, very few, but some of them endorsed the Nader candidacy in 2000.
Could you describe?
There were these other initiatives. There were local campaigns that brought together activists from both the Labor Party and other social movements.
Can you describe how the Labor Party initiative was different from this fusion strategy that the Working Families Party adopted? What's your understanding of fusion strategy here?
Fusion strategies, the idea of fusion is that that you vote. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry. That you can vote for the same candidate on multiple party lines. And the fusion voting has been around for a long time. I come from New York, and we've always had fusion voting in New York, and there's always been these minor parties that vote for major parties on their line. And the idea is that it gives you more leverage with the candidates, because Andrew Cuomo, who's running for governor in New York, wins by getting 45% of his votes from the Democratic Party and 6% of his votes from the Working Families Party. In theory, the Working Families Party should be able to influence his policies and politics. Our sense was that you can never really develop a party of the working class by supporting and endorsing representatives of the corporate parties. I mean, you might have to do that out of expediency and survival purposes, but to elevate that to a political principle and to think that ultimately it will pay off in some kind of enhanced power for the working class is just, you know, in my opinion, is delusional. It's a two-way street, and we, you know, folks in New York have just seen that, you know, as they think that they're influencing the policies of these politicians, what the politicians are doing is sort of dictating their politics to these parties.
So a fusion strategy is you have your own party, you put up your own candidates, but you tell your members to vote for one or the other?
You put up your own candidates. You nominate the same candidates that somebody else is doing. So occasionally you put up your own candidates, but you nominate, you know, the Working Families Party in New York nominated the Democratic governor of New York to run on their line. So when you vote in New York in November, you have the opportunity to vote for Andrew Cuomo on the Democratic Party line or on the Working Families Party line.
I see.
Probably two or three other minor party lines also.
Okay. Let's talk about membership in the Labor Party during those years. What did it mean to be a member? Did you pay dues? Did you have a card? What did you do? Or did you just vote in favor or come to meetings? What was it? What did it mean to be a member?
Yeah, members of the Labor Party, you could join the Labor Party. The dues were $20 a year, and we had annual membership drives, tried to recruit members. And as a member, we had a regular monthly newspaper that all members received. And we started, you know, using email and stuff like that to communicate with our members. Members participated in two ways. One, through their unions. A number of unions would have had union chapters that they organized their members into. And a number of unions actually set up checkoff systems where people would contribute like a dollar a week to the Labor Party as part of their dues checkoffs, political checkoffs. And then the other form of participation is we began to organize Labor Party chapters in cities around the country. So I think at our peak, we probably had about 50 chapters around the country. And these were, groups organized geographically of Labor Party members, and some of the organizational affiliates of the Labor Party participated in these chapters. And they came together to sort of discuss and debate party issues and party policy, and to engage in, you know, public work around the issues in the Labor Party program. So they were very, some of them were very active. Some of them became sort of debating societies rather than activist organizations. And, some of them were kind of stagnant, never really took off. There was sort of a mixed experience with the chapters. But, once you were a member of the Labor Party, you had a right to vote through your chapter representatives, on party issues, and you were represented at the national conventions, both through chapters and through an at-large representation system for people who weren't active in chapters, and then unions also were represented and had their own internal structures in terms of how they exercised that representation.
Can you describe what happened in the final years of the Labor Party initiative? I believe in the early 2000s is when it was finally disbanded.
Yep.
Can you describe what happened in the final years and why it was discontinued?
Yeah, well, I mean, a number of things happened beginning in 2000. A guy named George Bush stole the election in 2000 and declared himself, the Supreme Court declared him president. That changed some of the political dynamics. I mean, I heard your introduction to the show. I mean, he basically instituted a national accelerated the sort of union busting that had gone on and raised it to a new level in a lot of people's minds. Coupled with that was sort of the scapegoating of Ralph Nader as the cause of Bush's victory, which is pure fiction, but it was widely practiced, the scapegoating, particularly by liberal Democrats and their representatives in the labor movement. So for the first time, sort of the enemies of the Labor Party idea within the labor movement gained some real traction, you know, after the Bush victory by, you know, associating our project with Nader's failed campaign and accusing us of being spoilers and undermining, you know, real politics, et cetera, et cetera. So that created some new difficulties. And then, you know, labor by the 2000s had really that little moment of upsurge in the mid-90s had passed and had basically passed with a strategic defeat of the labor movement. We were unable to stop the sort of globalization projects that were launched with the passage of NAFTA. And, you know, that decimated particularly the industrial working class, but then that sort of created new conditions for the entire working class. And, you know, labor suffered a series of retreats, and we found it basically impossible to sort of, you know, move labor to advance on this broadly progressive political front when it was in broad retreat, you know, in all other areas. And so, you know, the traction and the momentum for the Labor Party faded away in the new political circumstances. It was even made even worse after 2000, the events of 9/11 and 2001, sort of the call for war and, you know, just an undermining of a lot of progressive political values and initiatives. You know, in addition to that, Tony Mazzocchi died in 2002, and, you know, while we didn't construct the party around his personality, and he was very careful to practice a very inclusive leadership style, you know, it was a real loss to the party, decades of experience and the credibility that he had on broad sections of the labor movement. So, you know, we experimented with a number of initiatives to try to, you know, maintain and regain some momentum for the party building project. But by the mid-00s, it was pretty clear that, you know, we just didn't have the capacity to continue to thrive as an independent party. The last project that we worked on was in 2007. We worked to build a South Carolina Labor Party that got ballot access by, you know, you had a petition to the state government.
So the Labor Party still lives on in abbreviated form in South Carolina, I guess you would say, at this point.
Hmm? Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's still a couple of organizations around that still do some basic work, but, you know, we suspended our active national operations in 2007. We launched the South Carolina Labor Party. That party still exists and is strongly supported by the unions in South Carolina and other organizations.
Okay. Well, you know, I would love to have you give us your assessment of what you would have done differently, looking back retrospectively here. But I think we're running out of time. Would you mind if at some point in the future we got you back with some of the South Carolina Labor Party folks to discuss what's happened since 2007?
And yeah, sure. I'd be glad
a
to
retrospective
that.
And a discussion?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, well, we're going to talk to some of these South Carolina folks, Donna DeWitt and others I know, and see if we can have a follow-up show on that. Maybe it might be appropriate following the midterm elections here when the Democrats lose the Senate. Anyway, I'd like to thank you very much, Mark. A very illuminating discussion here. And we'll be back next week. Next week, we're going to talk to some folks, local folks, who have won independently in Richmond, California, hopefully, maybe in Seattle. And let's continue this discussion of which way independent political action. Thanks, Mark, and we will follow up next week. So stay tuned next week, where we'll talk about some actual developments.
Bombs fell from the sky, no blood soaked the ground.